That got garbled a little bit, Scotty.
The U3 on your schematic is actually the magnetometer chip assembly, right? With the coils on and everything, not the chip itself.
Microphone
That's
muted.
correct. Yeah, I did it with the assembly. You know, if we want to do something different than that, we need to talk about it a bunch because we're into way more into the manufacturing aspects that I don't know about.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. I think Yeoman was talking about that. We're going to have make sure that the coils get mounted with a certain precision. Otherwise, it's not going to work right, not going to be calibratable.
Yeah, and I don't know if we do that and trust some board house to build them for us. I just don't know how good they are.
I think we can get them to do it for us, assuming we can tell them what it is that we want them to do.
There may be some specs for that. I'm not sure. I've read so much about it, I forget now. The other thing was the price of, you know, like full reels of those components. I had the idea that, well, you know, they're, it's about $15 for onesies of the full kit, and what it might be for
user joined your channel,
you know, enough to send to, for assembly. It depends on, you know, how much you can get them for.
Yeah, that's a manufacturing issue that we'll have to deal with at some point. But the other thing that you can do is put the, I don't know what other components are on the board besides the magnetometer, but put both of them on the board. It's not that big of a board, and then we can manufacture it either way.
Yeah, I thought of that too. I also thought of making a small, you know, thin, castellated board like those Chinese ones I had, and, you know, have a footprint on the board where you could just kind of sweat solder it into place if you didn't want the pin hitters.
Yep, either way would work.
I didn't go out of my way to avoid through-hole connectors, obviously, because I thought they'd be the things that people might do differently. But the, you know, it'd probably be a lot more manufacturable if we didn't have them.
User entered your channel.
Well, and this could be something simple enough that we might actually be able to make a kit of it, you know, if you use large SMT parts.
Yeah, I didn't use what I consider large, but I know they're large by the industry standards now. I think I used 603s mostly.
Yeah, and my threshold for large is 0805. If it's 0805 or bigger, then it should be easy for anyone to do it. You get down to those 603s, those 402s, then some people are going to have trouble.
Yeah, not least me. But the 4s and the 2-0-whatevers and the 2-0-whatevers are just, you know, no way.
Your CM wanted us to use 01005s. And I asked him if he had ever manufactured anything with those, and he said no. So I'm going like, oh, yeah, so you want us to be the guinea pig, huh?
User entered your channel.
Yeah. Now, I have been, my thought all along has been to make this kind of design I'm making right now is just a prototype and something I would send to somebody like OSH Park that would crank them out quick. And then could put them together and test them.
Okay, well, we can talk about this
User
further. Dave's here now.
Out. Oh. User entered your channel.
There he is. He left and he came back. So we were just leading in, Dave. So you want to take it away?
Okay, well, I can try. I'm just getting all set up, but sorry I was a bit late. I heard you were talking to Dave, KD0EAG. So next on the list is Mike, AAAK, shown as recording in a way, or Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TS, the TeamSpeak recording to tsarchive.tangerine.sdr, wait, tangerinesdr.com. And next on the list is Nathan in 2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Thank you very much, Steve. Here I am, W2NAF. Things are going fine this week. It's been very busy, as always. It seems like every week is very busy. But I guess one thing, we got a lot of really good press this week because the University of Scranton put out a press release about the grant, and that was picked up by a lot of people, so that was really nice. So I'm continuing to work with building up the radio club at school. I gave another talk this week to another group of students about the work that we're doing. We have about four or five students now who are starting to work on various radio projects. And so they're working mostly with me, but now also with another professor on the same sort of thing. So this is really good. And I think both Tom and Scotty used some of my slides to put together a talk as well. Okay, W2NAF, back to Nat.
Well, fine business, Nathan. And next on the list, we have Ned, AA7A. Go ahead, Ned.
Okay. You copy me okay?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, I hate to do a long soliloquy here and not be punching the right hotkey. Yeah, I've been off for a couple weeks. I completed installing our AirSpy SDR out at our remote site, and we have it now wired into the constellation of 16 directional beverages. And I got to tell you, yeah, I've been playing with electronics and been a ham for 50 some years, and this was one really cool experience of being able to it's like shortwave listening on steroids. Going on the broadcast band and tuning the frequency dial and then tuning the spatial dial. On a particular AM channel, I can spin the array around, virtually there, and I can listen to five or six different stations in five and six different directions. It's just an incredible system. No idea how to, start collecting data on this thing. There's just so many things going on, but we're at least, quote, on the air, unquote, and able to start working on the next step, which is to start collecting data that we can trust. And that's a long, long topic. As I've told you guys before, I'm a retired communications engineer, and I get this stuff, and I'm a little confused about some of the nomenclature in SDR software. I'm currently using SDR console, and it displays data. He calls the data in power units DBM, but it's clearly not DBM. It's something else, and I've got to figure out what everybody's talking about when they display information in their software, because I'm a little concerned about making a claim about this or that and not being able to really support it with some hard evidence. So the next job I have ahead is to try to create a spectrum analyzer that I can trust both software-defined radio and associated software. So that's what's going on here. Lots and lots of stuff. Probably have a lot of information you guys would be interested in. I'd be happy to take on questions or little projects if you want. We have quite a thing now working out in the desert out there in southeastern Arizona. So back to Nat.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic tool, and now it's just finding the which ways you want to use it. So next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody on the group. Good week. I appreciate Scotty and Nathaniel providing slides, and mixed up those with a few other slides, performed PowerPoint surgery, and made a presentation at the local radio club last Thursday on Tangerine SDR and the Personal Space Weather Station. A little bit over the heads of some folks, but I think there was some genuine interest there, so very encouraging. The other activities, spent most of the week working on corrections to the schematic for the receiver, and I've made three passes and found major mistakes on each pass, so I think there'll be a few more passes before we're ready to declare the schematic ready. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Tom, and glad you're making progress. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Did you already talk about yourself, Scotty?
No, and actually, Dave really didn't give us an update of everywhere he's at. We were just kind of talking about some specific things because he sent me a schematic for a view. So might want to have him give us an update too when it comes around on the guitar, so to speak. Anyway, here, oh, and by the way, thanks for running this again as usual. We really appreciate it. And this week was mostly working on the QEX article for Tangerine and also an article for the PSR. So I've got two publications coming up. And also, thank you, Tom and Nathaniel, both for your slides, too. I gave a presentation at a local radio club here on Wednesday. And we had a little bit of trouble getting a projector going, so I got started a little late. But my 45-minute presentation ran into 90 minutes, and everybody was awake and asking questions and seemed interested. So I would have cut it at 45, but they seemed to want more information, so I kept on going. So because I kind of planned it as mostly the space weather station info at the front end, and you know, why do we want to do this? What are we trying to measure? That kind of thing. And then I went into the, and that was pretty much the whole 45 minutes. Then I went into the second half, which was what's the Tangerine STR and what's it going to do and what does it look like and what are we actually going to build? So it turned out pretty good. And one of the guys is also a member of the Arizona Repeater Association. And now he wants me to come give the same presentation to the ARA meeting later this month. So we'll see how that all works out. And trying to think if there's anything else. I think that's it for this week. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, thank you, Dave. And hello, everyone. Just to catch up a little bit, this is the November 12th, O200 Zulu meeting of Tangerine SDR on TeamSpeak. I think we forgot to throw that out there. I think you thought, Dave, that we were a little bit further along than we actually were when you stepped in. So anyway, to summarize my activities, I really did a lot this past week, but didn't do much radio. My daughter came to visit on Thursday, and she was here for 4 days, and that pretty much took that time up. And I think I worked about 20 hours this week, which took up the rest of the week. So did have a chance to putz around a little bit with the N2 board. Kind of wiped out the SD card that I had originally done, reinstalled the latest version of Ubuntu Mate, and recompiled LinHPSDR. After a little bit of fumbling around, got it all working, and it works about the same as it did before. So anyway, I guess that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Dan. Sorry that you didn't get an improvement, but at least it's still working, more or less.
Yeah, it does work. No question about that. It just has some glitches in it that I think really should not be there. And it very well could be because we're sampling at 384 kilobits per second. So I think that's just a little bit of a load for that CPU to handle for whatever reasons.
User in your channel timed out. User entered your channel.
Sorry for that. I've been having some glitchy problems with my internet recently, and so I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but hopefully you can still hear me.
Yeah, you're loud and clear, Dave.
Okay, let's go back to Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, yeah. Sorry we talked over the beginning. I've been working on a schematic for the magnetometer component pretty heavily for the last week, and I even have gotten down to a preliminary routing of a board, but really haven't settled all the schematic issues yet, so still collecting some advice. But otherwise, progressing well. Have some things for people to critique as very shortly.
Yeah, I didn't give a report about myself. this week I've been fairly busy. Had coffee with Dave and we talked over projects, and I'm still getting up to speed on some programming stuff again, and it's just starting to work. I'm catching up with my grading at work, which is everybody's favorite thing to do. And we also had a several repairmen. I had an electrician, and I had a new that brought me a new modem for my internet, and also had the carpets cleaned. So busy week, and around the house as well. So I get to go to the dentist tomorrow. So fun things, but I'm going to be back at it here as soon as I get a little time in between all these appointments. Anyway, that leaves us to the end of the list, and we're open for general discussion.
For those of you interested in Vim 3 boards, I just put a website down there and the coupon codes. If you're interested in buying anything from these guys, they're the source for the Vim 3. And I think if you tried real hard, you could get yourself above $200. If you don't really want to, you can stay close to $100. So whichever you like, but they're pretty cool boards.
Those look good, Scotty. I haven't used those before.
They seem to do as good as the N2. So it'll be interesting to see if we get them in some kind of head-to-head comparison, because Dan and I loaded them on. Well, we loaded our N2s up when he was out here, what, a couple weeks ago. And Dan, I don't know if you figured out where the bottleneck is. It doesn't seem like the CPUs are maxing out, but yet we seems like you hear clicks and pops like we're losing packets. So it's about the same on the Vim 3. It sounds about the same, just occasional clicks and pops. So it's and about 60% CPU uses on one core, 40% on another core, and then very low on the other two. So not really straining much.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell where it's coming from right now. I need to kind of look at it in more detail. I mean, it very well could be just packet transport issues.
But I mean, we're point to point, so there should be no collisions.
Yeah, true, but it's fairly pretty high data rate, I think, for, well, I don't know, it should be able to handle that.
Well, it's 384K slice, so I don't know. It if a Raspberry Pi 3 can keep up, it would seem like this thing should do much better than that.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course, we're running, what, Pi HPSDR on one and Lin HPSDR on the other. I'm not sure really what the differences are.
Yeah, Scotty, are you using the audio ALSA or jack drivers on Linux?
Yeah, I think we're using the jack drivers, aren't we, Dan?
No, actually, well, I have used the jack drivers. It doesn't seem to make much difference. I actually understand jack pretty well from about 6 or 7 years ago, believe it or not. And I think I've got it jack pretty well optimized for what we're doing.
Okay.
As opposed to you don't know jack? Sorry, I couldn't resist. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, there were reports of issues with the audio drivers in GNU Radio probably 2 years ago on the GNU Radio mailing list.
Well, I have a LCD monitor that's HDMI and it has speakers in it, and I've actually used ALSA to selected that Dan on the menu and sent the audio to the speakers in the monitor, and I don't really see any difference. I don't hear any difference. I still hear the occasional clicks and pops. So I, you know, either they're all kind of not very good or that's not the problem.
I don't know if it has any pertinence here, but I believe in the past when I was playing with things, I had all kinds of mysterious audio problems a long time ago, especially with working with FreeDV. And I ended up, this was on Intel processor, but using one of the so-called real-time kernels, optimized kernels, or with some of the patches, it cleared up a lot of it for me back then. I don't know if that anything like that's available for these devices, though.
Well, I guess you can use any kernel you want as long as you kind of take care of the problems that happen between the kernel and the rest of the OS. So maybe I ought to look for a real-time kernel. I actually used real-time kernel with Jack a number of years ago, And I agree, it does make a big, big difference in how the system performs.
I'm just not sure if that even exists for these ARM processors. I don't remember seeing one.
Well, I do remember seeing a switch someplace in the software for using real-time processing, but again, it probably depends a little bit on the definition of real-time processing.
With Intel, it was enough to make a difference, but there's so much variation, you know, in audio on Linux. It's hard to know what's going to work.
Yeah, and I actually bought a SoundBlaster 3 USB dongle sound card thingy, and which is supposed to be, you know, one of the better ones out there in terms of the chip that's in it, and that's still having issues with that.
Yeah, so your sound sounded about the same as mine with the when I was using jack and the built-in sound HDMI port I was listening on. It sounded the same, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yeah, there wasn't any difference.
So it'd be interesting if we had to have to switch front ends, go back to Hermes or something, and slow it down to 192K or 96K and see if that makes a difference.
Yeah, I could give that a try. I think I need to sit down and put together a little action plan and then take a little closer look at things.
Yeah, because the IQ2 doesn't support the lower data rates, so you have to use different hardware. One interesting thing is, Dan, I ran into a KB7KY at the Scottsdale Radio Club meeting that I gave the presentation on, and he is now retired, and he's a networking guy, so I'm going to try to drag him into this whole protocol discussion. He's telling me some things that I need to know that apparently he thinks that I didn't know, which is true. But getting an experienced network guy to ping things off of would be really a good thing.
Agreed.
And since he's retired now, he has some time, and he seems to be interested in this stuff, so maybe I can get him interested enough to help with the networking. That would be awesome.
User in your channel timed out. User entered your channel.
You sure recover quickly, Dave. You pop out, and then you come right back so fast it's hard to believe.
Well, the popping back is not by me. It's the system. It seems to time out on data requests, and then the data request finally comes back, and so it pops back on.
I have several times had the problem that as these sessions go on, you know, get past the halfway point or a little further, I get more and more something, buffer congestion or something, and I have more and more trouble understanding people. Finally have to give up. I did restart my machine one time. That seemed to help.
Well, I hope I don't have to do that.
Yeah, welcome to Windows 10 now, restart. So, and I talked to John Ackerman a little bit earlier today, and he's been working on some background tasks for the qualifying GPSs. So he says he should have something in a few weeks if he doesn't keep getting distracted with background tasks instead of the main task. So Tom, was that library part that I sent you of any help, the one with all the labels in it?
I didn't try it. I moved some things around and got all the signals wired to the connector. It's kind of a sea of lines flowing around it, but I got it hooked up without any intra-page connectors.
Yeah, because I split the connector into a four-part package. So I think if you want to take the time to do that on one of your next iterations, it'll be way easier because every line is has got two-tenths of an inch between. So you can bus every line anywhere you want.
Okay, that's certainly a help. I got it figured out by angling the bus interconnects every which way to Sunday. And, you know, that left exactly one gap in each block to get through. So that was good. I'm just doing sanity checks. I found two library errors I made, and I'm going down the list of parts. So I'm trying to get this thing clean before I rip out the connector yet again.
It's always good to check the pinouts at least three times, because if it's wrong, it'll be wrong.
Yeah, I got one of those already and fixed those two parts. So I'm going to try to be methodical in going down the list of parts I created.
Yeah, and I'm a really big fan of modifying the part shapes for the schematic page they go on so that it routes cleanly. And that may mean I have different graphical symbols for the same part, you know, moving pins around depending on what schematic they're on. So some people don't think that that's a good idea, but I really like to have readable schematics. That's why I'm kind of, and I like kind of like the idea of having the labels inside the connector, because that way I think you had mentioned you'd change some. Well, this will show up immediately, the ones that you changed that I don't know about.
Okay, well, that's probably good. Yeah, I'm not using that one yet. Quick question on electrolytic capacitors. I used lots of ones that you had in your library. They're not marked with polarity. Should I assume pin one is the positive terminal?
They need to have a plus sign on the graphic, and typically, usually, yes, pin one is plus. But are you sure that they're polarized? Because there's a lot of pretty big ceramic capacitors these days that are not polarized. I think everyone that I use that's either tantalum or aluminum would have a polarity mark on it. Should have.
Okay. Well, I've used some 10 microfarads and some 22 microfarad capacitors from your library, and none of them had any pluses on them.
Yeah, and I'll bet those are X7Rs if you look at them.
Okay, I'll double check that. I just wanted to make sure I didn't goof something up.
Nope, those are likely ceramics. I'll be almost guaranteed they are, because a lot of the switching supplies that we build, they require ceramics, those high mu ceramics or whatever they call them.
Okay, well, those are good. Those will make great bypass capacitors.
Yeah, they're expensive though.
Okay, well, I've got a bucket load of them on here.
I was looking for capacitors on it from the distributors, and I saw several kinds I'd never heard of before, and the X7R, I think X7S or something like that. I guess they are kind of ceramics.
Well, X7Rs are pretty much the best, I think. X5Rs are okay. I'm gonna make me look up the other ones. There's some of them that are really not very good. I mean, they're like plus 10 minus 20%, and they vary all over the place for temperature, and they're really not happy when you run like a 6.3 volt capacitor at 5 volts. You really want to run, if you're going to run it at 5, you really want like a 16 volt or higher capacitor, because they don't like being run right up near the limit. They won't burn them out, they just don't have either the ESR or the capacitance that you think. The capacitance decreases with voltage, not a good thing.
Okay, I'll have to check that. I've got, I put the higher voltage ones on the 5 volt and the 12 volt lines, and I used the 10 volt caps on the 3.3 and the 1.8 volt lines.
Yeah, 10 should be okay, but you know, I've seen some people use 4.5 volt caps on 3.3 volt lines, you know, because you don't, I mean, that should be enough, right? But no, it really isn't.
I expect a 6.3 volt on that filter arrangement, because DigiKey had them in stock or something like that, but I was kind of winging it, and I wasn't sure if I didn't need something a little bigger.
Was that on 5 volts or on 3 volts?
Jeez. I will double check that. I can't remember, but I know I would have felt better, but they just, I don't think they had stock on what I was looking at at least at 16 volts. I don't know. I'll look.
Yeah. And part of the problem is when you stick with 0402 size, when you get into the higher capacitances, the prices go up and the choices go down. So, I mean, you can find, I think, 10 microfarad caps in 0402s at like 16 volts. But wow, look at the prices of them. So then in that case, I would use an 0603 or an 0805, especially if you're using big caps like 47 mics or even 100 mics. If you want those small, you're going to really pay through the nose.
Well, I'm happy to use bigger ones. And the 0805s suit me just fine. But I was trying to do trying to guess what was the right thing to do.
You know, when I did the power supply for HPSDR, that was going to be a kit. I used 0805s or bigger, some 1206s even. And unless you really have to use small ones, don't use small ones. And then I guess you figured this out too, that when you get to really big ones, then the price starts going up again, right?
Yeah, I had understood there were real shortages of them in certain sizes, just because they hadn't been, at least a few months ago, just because the manufacturers weren't keeping up with the demand. But the 08 is probably fine as far as I'm concerned. And I have, for my purpose, I have lots of room, probably making the board too big. In fact, I wanted to ask, is there a desired size for that board, for the magnetometer board? I'm just giving myself elbow room.
Yeah, the best size is narrow, because we're going to have a USB connector on one side and a power connector on the other. So you can go out as far as, the length. So put the connector on the short end and you make the length anything you want, but don't make the width real wide. So in other words, don't make it square.
Okay, well, with the board designed as a, to take the magnetometer,
your channel timed out.
The pre-made module.
User entered your channel.
With it designed to use the pre-made module, the narrowest it can be is the long axis of the module itself. So, which isn't that small, but it's not real big either.
Let's see. They have this on the the Digilit pin, Digilit website here. Of course, they have the 8-pin one, but not the 12-pin one.
Yeah, that's where a lot of my confusion was coming from.
But I'm gonna say, 15 millimeters. I don't. What does the magnetometer board? How wide is it?
I'm pretty sure it's at least 20. I haven't actually measured it in a while, and my head for numbers is not as good as it used to be.
Okay, well, I guess make it as narrow as you can, given that constraint, and then we'll just deal with it.
That'll do.
Do you think you're going to need to put parts on both sides?
Not at this point. The components aren't, other than the magnetometer module, is not an issue. If I use enough vias, I can get anywhere, but I've been trying to minimize that as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that would be kind of slick is you could actually mount the discrete magnetometer parts underneath the PC board magnetometer, because you're never going to have both of them on the board, and that way it would cut the area down.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of with a small module that soldered, that went straight onto the board, a castellated module. But that may be just excess complexity.
I think that's correct, because if we're going to build the castellated module, then we're going to have to know how to mount the magnetics. So if we're going to know how to mount the magnetics, you might as well just mount them on the board.
Yeah, I imagine that's right. I just like those little castellated modules that, could be sweated right onto a footprint, but you're right. It's one more thing.
Scotty, I had one weird design error pop up. I used a 3.3 for a 3.3 volt power, and it marked as indicating it was connected on one page but not connected on the other page. And so I changed it to 3, the letter P in 3. And all of a sudden, it seems like everything was wired up.
So was that using a power symbol or using an intersheet symbol?
Using a power symbol.
Okay, because it should take periods. So I'm not sure, except that sometimes if you make 3.3 or 3.3V, obviously you're not the same. Or 3.0 and 3 are not the same. So is it possible you just had a unique name for that particular power block?
I checked it pretty carefully. It appeared to have the identical name on all the pages, but didn't wire up all the pages. So I went ahead and removed the decimal and substitute a letter P, and everything wired up okay after that.
Yeah, I usually like to not use decimal points, and I don't like to use plus signs either. So I'll put like 3P3 or neg 5 or something like that, so I don't have to put punctuation in there. And it will not like connecting up power block names and sheet-to-sheet connector names. I think it'll give you an error, or it may just not connect them and create two nets, and then you're stuck.
Okay. Well, I got rid of all of the intersheet connectors for power and went to the symbol. I used the identical symbol for all the different supply voltages, but gave them different names. Is that okay?
Yeah, the symbol doesn't matter. The name—it's all those are grouped together under different names, just like the grounds. The same thing. Put a ground A or ground B or anything like that. You change the name, then that becomes a new net. But it's treated differently than a regular net name because it's a global net name for power.
Okay, very good. Well, maybe something like that happened. Anyway, I changed them all, and it seemed to be happy after that.
Yeah, one of the things that we do, too, is after you're all done, you think everything is good, we go in and look at the net list, and specifically the power, because if you see two power nets that look like they might be the same, like 5P0 and 5P that you messed up on, you'll see it right away in the net list.
Okay, I'll add that to my checklist.
Yeah, most of these things are inspired by errors that we foolishly made in the past. Like anything that's polarized, capacitors, LEDs, and especially connectors, we triple check. Because if anything's going to be wrong, it's going to be a diode or a capacitor or a connector. It's going to be hooked up backwards or mirrored or something.
Yeah. Of course, I just did electrical on all of the parts. I'm going to be relying on someone else to do the actual physical component.
Yeah. And the way I do that is I just, if you put the manufacturer data sheet in there, our guy goes to DigiKey, looks it up, gets the data sheet, pulls the PCB footprint right off the data sheet and matches it up to either something he has or he builds a new one for us. So we get a good read in, as he says. That's when he can read the whole thing in and all the decals match, then he has a good read in.
Okay, very good. I'll make a couple more passes. When do you think we are ready to give the layout guy his first look?
Oh, okay. I don't know. I mean, I'm not ready just yet, but you're going to be first in line. So I did talk to him this week. He's pretty busy, but that comes and goes. So, you know, next week he could have nothing to do. So anytime you're ready, we can get put in the queue.
Okay. I hope I'll try to get him something or get you something next week. I'll leave it on Dropbox so you can get it to him. And hopefully we'll be done. I'm doing sweepstakes this weekend, so we'll shoot 3 days out of the week.
Okay, that'll be fun. But on the schematic, really the thing he needs is a list of part numbers. So if you're not really done with the interconnection, I mean, we're not really in a big rush at this point, but if you're pretty much sure of the parts that are going to be there and the package types are going to be, that's why I mentioned that on the manufacturer part number, you have to put the fully qualified part number, including all of the dash numbers and the things that denote package type and speed grade. So we want an orderable part number there because he's going to use that number to get the decal.
Okay, I put the fully qualified part number in the library part name.
Okay, did you put it in the MFRPN property?
Don't know about that. I'll have to check.
Okay, because the MFRPN and the vendor part number, vendor PN, I have to be able to cut them, paste them into Google, or in the DigiKey page, or just into Google, and it should come up with the real parts. So, and I know some of the parts are available in multiple different packages, so we have to make sure and tell them which package we're going to use.
Okay. Well, I'm pretty close. I'll generate a bill of materials and a cross-reference list, and that should give you at least a first list. The bill of materials is less than one page.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I've got some time reserved to go through and double check. It's always good to have an extra pair of eyes. When I get my schematic done, I'll send it over to you, and I'm sure Dave will do the same. We'll all look at them and see if we can find anything wrong before we post them up for public ridicule.
User in your channel timed out.
Okay, very good. I'll get you something probably the beginning of next week then.
Okay, that sounds great, and good luck in the sweepstakes.
Thanks. We're doing a multi-op at a friend's house, so we'll hopefully have a lot of fun, and with enough multi-ops, nobody has to run too long.
So you'll be coherent on Monday then?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay, as coherent as usual then?
Yeah, as coherent as I ever get.
So Nathaniel, hey, Scotty. Go ahead.
I was going to ask if you got any good questions when you gave your talk the other night.
Well, your channel. Yeah, I got some questions that I couldn't answer. But let's see, let me think a bit here. It's the kind of questions I got. They were interested in VHF and UHF operations somewhat. So, you know, I told them we were going to have plug-in modules, but not really any specifics just yet as far as different modules. And, I'm trying to think that. Because one guy had mentioned that there was already a network of like Kiwi SDRs, which probably Rob could answer if he was on here. But is there a network of those guys that are collecting data now?
I believe there is. I've seen their webpage, and I think if you just Google that, you'll get their webpage.
Okay, because that was one of the questions, and. Then just seemed to be they were all very interested, which was good, I guess.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, Nathaniel, I had a couple of questions folks were asking. I showed the little movie of the tsunami in Japan and how it caused TIDs, and that caused a huge number of questions about what are the other effects that can cause TIDs besides tsunami.
Certainly hurricanes can. Hurricanes, tornadoes, things like that. There's some talk that earthquakes might be able to cause some. Anything, so of course I did work with the polar vortex too. There's all sorts of things that can cause TIDs.
Okay, that the putting the video up really seemed to spark a lot of folks. They thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's a really nice video. It shows it really well. Tsunamis, and as I said, I think earthquakes as well, and tornadoes. There's a really good video of a tornado in using the TIDs as well, and a nice paper on that.
Okay, yeah, there was one question if volcanoes would cause a TID.
I haven't seen that, so I'm not sure. I wouldn't rule it out.
Okay, I would think if a tornado would, that probably a volcano would, but that's just a kind of a gut feel.
Well, I agree with that, and that's why I would say I would not rule it out.
Well, they were encouraging questions.
Wait for the next Mount St. Helens eruption to measure a ionosphere.
Say, I did a little research and found at least what the error messages my TeamSpeak 3 is sending. Apparently, as of TeamSpeak 3.1, there's a TS3 DNS requirement that the port number is 41144. And I'm not sure, is our TeamSpeak still hosted in Oregon by Annalisa?
Yes, it is. And that was a specific port number that I requested because the default port number goes to the OpenHPSDR TeamSpeak server.
Well, I listed the 7388 is the port number that we're using, and somehow my software is getting confused, and it times me out until it figures it out again, and so that's what's the error messages in the screen. I'm wondering if there's a place where I can enter the port number and force it.
Yeah, I have the port number entered in the server address in my bookmark. I don't know if you have that or not.
User disconnected from your channel. User entered your channel. User entered your channel.
So I don't know if you got that, Dave. I said that my in my address book, I specify the port number also.
Yeah, I did get it, and I do have the port number in my address book. One thing that's interesting is it seems as the real, the names recorded are lowercase t's instead of uppercase t's.
Where, in your bookmarks?
My bookmark is uppercase t's, and what I'm getting back in the error messages are TeamSpeak, Tangerine, with lowercase t's.
I don't think that should matter, but it could conceivably.
I'm running on a Linux version of TeamSpeak. I don't know if that makes a difference either.
Yeah, I'm running on Linux as well, and I think, Dave W., you're running on Linux too, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
I'm just looking at the address for Tapper TeamSpeak server, and it's all lowercase.
User disconnected from your channel. User entered your channel.
Well, now Dan's starting to do the same thing that you are, Dave.
No, that's, well, self-induced.
Oh, okay.
But what I'm getting is server DNS resolve unsuccessful for TeamSpeak, TangerineSDR.com, and then it parrots out a whole bunch of stuff, and then finally figures out that it should be 7388, and then it seems to work okay. And I did send a link of the TS3 DNS error message. It's saying that the DNS software is expecting 41144 as a port number.
I didn't think DNS provided port number, just the IP portion of the address.
This is the TeamSpeak DNS, not the general DNS.
So is this something that Annalise set up that's changed?
I think it's something that TeamSpeak is doing in their... What they're doing is DNS for only TeamSpeak users.
So, Dave, when you first start up TeamSpeak, what it says, welcome to TeamSpeak, check, blah, blah, blah. But what does the line before that say?
I'm looking for what you're asking for. I get at least looking.
So down at the bottom, there should be a number of entries that have like a solid circle with an eye in the center and a timestamp. And then one of those will say teamspeak.tangerinesdr.com and then the port number.
Yeah, Dan, mine says trying to resolve hostname teamspeak.tangerinesdr.com, all lowercase. Then it says trying to connect a server on teamspeak.tangerinesdr.com:7388. And then it says welcome to TeamSpeak. Check teamspeak.com for latest information and then connect it to server. And then I'm on.
Yeah, that's exactly what mine says.
User entered your channel.
This is going to be unfortunate if it imposes that port number.
It doesn't seem to be enforcing it on me.
One thing I did is...
User disconnected from your channel.
Not that long ago, I set up, reinstalled TeamSpeak about a week or two ago. So, because it wouldn't do the upgrade, actually. So I'm not sure if I should back it up or not.
So what version are you running now? It's newer than 3.2.3, right?
3.3.2, and I installed it about two weeks ago, but Dan seems to be running the same version.
I'm pretty certain I'm using exactly the same setup too.
Mike is as well.
And I'm using the older version because it keeps bugging me to update, and I'm going like, no.
I updated and nothing really bad happened.
And it allowed you to update without having to reinstall everything?
Yeah.
Well, one of these days I'll cave in and do that, but I remember one time right before the HPSDR TeamSpeak session, it asked me if I wanted to update, and I said, sure, and it broke things, and I missed the whole session. I couldn't get it to work again. I had to uninstall it and reinstall the whole thing, so that's good to hear that worked anyway.
Don't do it just before the session, but usually after the session's a good time.
Dave, I'm looking at something called client log. Is that the where you are looking for your error messages?
Well, I run my, I start my client in a terminal, and so it gets a long log. Is there another place I should look?
Yeah, if you bring up tools and then client log under the tools menu, it will give you a log of how you got logged into TeamSpeak and what DNSs had to resolve. And then once you figured out where TeamSpeak.TangerineSDR.com was located, it hooks you up to the client UI, and then you resolve the port. It gives you all of that stuff.
That's pretty much the same stuff that's in my terminal window.
Okay.
I think there's a lot more information in the log that's in the terminal window.
No, it's exactly the same.
Okay, because you're firing it off from a terminal window, not as an application under Windows. So, okay, I get it.
Well, I'm Linux, Scotty.
Yeah. So you open a window, and then you type TeamSpeak 3 or whatever, and it then you get to see all the messages.
Yes. And it's finding the two ports on the 208 machine, and it finally figures out that the 7388 port is the one that I was connected to. But somehow it keeps checking that on my machine, so I don't know how to tell it check it once or twice, but not every few minutes.
Yeah, Dave, mine tries when I first start the session to find TSDNS on port 41144. It fails. It tries it a second time and fails. And then it says the client UI found it instead on port 7388, but then it's solid after that.
Yeah, and that's what mine's doing as well, except every so often it goes connecting puzzle solve time 7, and then it goes on down the list.
Okay, I get the puzzle solve time, and then it's connected, and it stays connected after that point. So something, this is on Windows.
It said something about tried to request user integration info without valid session, drop client 12 because of ping timeout, and got command data while disconnected, dropping disconnect. I did try changing my bookmark to lowercase characters.
In your bookmark, do you have the port number as well in the server nickname or address?
Yes, I do.
Okay, it sounds like it's configured the same as the one here.
I'm just wondering, like I said earlier, or last Thursday, I changed my my internet modem, or my cable modem that the network connects to.
That sounds like the likely suspect to me.
I'll have to compare with you, Dave. I think we have the same provider, and I can compare notes with you.
Okay. I'm sending you my log.
So, Nathaniel, did you have anything to do with that publicity that came out, or did they scout it out on their own?
I had a little bit to do with it. They basically came to me and said, we want to do this story, and then they interviewed me. I actually had him come to the talk that I gave to the students to the IEEE meeting, so he heard my talk and then wrote up the story, and I said it looked good, and then they put it out.
All right, it was really excellent.
Yeah, I was really happy about it, and then the ARRL picked it up, and a lot of other people. I saw some people pointed out it ended up on the amateur radio Reddit group as well, so it did really well.
That's really great publicity. Did ARRL contact you, or did they just pick it up straight from the university?
Let's see. Yeah, so Rick Lindquist did contact me. Ward tipped him off to it. It was funny because I was actually sending Rick an email about it just at the same time that I got an email from him. So it was kind of mutual there. So yeah, the ARRL did contact me.
Oh, that's great. It's good when things happen that way. You don't have to explain stuff to folks.
Rick has been really good with me. Every once in a while I send him something and he gets it up on the website pretty quickly, and he does a nice job.
Yeah, it was a beautiful press release, so it was really well done, and congratulations. There's a whole lot more work behind that than just the press release.
Oh, I know, absolutely. Well, that particular news article was written by University of Scranton a PR media person named Stan Zygmunt. So he was the lead author on that.
Well, he did a good job. It's fortunate you have a good group there. Some I've worked for organizations where something like that would take probably 30 to 60 days to get written and approved.
Yeah, no, I was really happy with it. And I mean, this is kind of a big deal for the University of Scranton too, because I mean, this is the biggest federal research grant I think they've had in a while. So it's a really nice thing.
Well, they didn't know about this when they hired you, right?
No, they didn't. They knew that I was applying for these sorts of things, but they hired me without actually knowing I had the grant.
Well, congratulations anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, it's worked out really well. So it's I guess the next thing is just keep plugging along. I need to hire a postdoc soon. I still have some more papers I need to get out. I'm planning on going to the American Geophysical Union meeting this December, and I think some people started posting the HAMSI listserv about that already. So we will have a bunch of people there at the AGU meeting. So there's quite a bit going on.
Yeah, that's the one in San Francisco, right?
That's right.
I looked through that website. It looks overwhelming.
Oh my gosh. That is, a lot of people don't like that meeting because it's so big. I like big things, so I'm okay with it. But one thing that is a little tough this year is a lot of the presentations I want to go to, they're all on Friday morning. So, I think you were talking to Larry Dodd from Radio Jove. He sent me a poster that Sheng Feng, he's a NASA scientist on Radio Jove, he's going to be giving at AGU, and that's on Friday morning. At the same time as that is my wife Rachel is giving a poster on Friday morning, and I'm giving my talk on Friday morning at 10:30 a.m. So it's just, with this whole week, all of these sessions I want to go to are all on Friday morning.
And they're only given once for the weekend, right?
That's right. Posters, you can have a little bit more flexibility with. The poster sessions, each of them will be 4 hours at a time. So it's, I can go see Rachel's poster and hang out with her for a bit, and then I can still run and go give my talk. And I can probably still catch up with Sheng Feng at some point as well. So the talks are a little bit, more rigid in terms of the schedule. David Kasdan and Christina Collins, they will be there, and David's giving a poster on Thursday. And last year, I think I put together a list on the HAMSI website of people who were giving HAMSI-related talks. I'll probably do that at some point again soon, too.
Hey, is there a place that David's posting his progress on the WWV receiver?
I don't know. I know that I've seen Rob Weisler reply to Bill Engelke's posts on the Tangerine SDR list. So I know they've been posting there. And I've been trying to get Dave to come to this telecon, which we've got him on here a couple times, but it'd be nice to get him on a little bit longer. He and Christina have been joining me for the Thursday at 3 p.m. We have these telecons every other Thursday. And that's been more on the science side of things than like the hardware design. So when I've been talking with them on the Thursday telecons, we've been looking at the data that they collected for the festival frequency measurements and trying to figure out what to do with that next, more so than looking at the hardware. But the thing is, the festival frequency measurement project that they just did, that sort of data is the same kind of data that they're looking at collecting with their personal space weather station. And so I think they're getting a lot of lessons learned out of looking at the data collected for that particular project.
Oh, okay. If you could send me the link to that Thursday session, if it's open, I wouldn't mind attending.
Yeah, I'll be glad to do that.
Just lurk and fly on the wall.
Yeah, I think I posted something to Tangerine SDR about a week ago about that. And I know I added a few people who asked me to.
Yeah, I seem to remember that. Go ahead, Dave. You get everything fixed?
It seems to be stable. I looked at the log things and they match what Dave has on his, so I think I figured it out. I do need to go, so I wanted to say 73 and talk to you next week.
Okay, 73, Dave, and yeah, we're over a little bit, so we probably ought to wrap it up here.